Trauma Therapist Podcast, episode 456. All right, guys, welcome to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. My name is Guy McPherson. My mission is to raise awareness of trauma and to support new trauma therapists just starting out on their trauma-informed journey. I do that through this podcast and my membership community, Trauma Therapist 2.0. If you're a therapist of any kind, interested in learning about trauma, and you're looking for support and inspiration, I invite you to check out Trauma Therapist 2.0 by going to traumatherapist2.com. That's Trauma Therapist, the number 2. All right, let's get started. Welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. I am very excited and really honored to have back here Pat Ogden. Pat, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here, Guy.
So Pat is a pioneer in somatic psychology and both founder and education director of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute, an internationally recognized school specializing in somatic cognitive approaches for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and attachment disturbances. Pat is co-founder of the Comey Institute, a clinician, consultant, international lecturer, and trainer, and first author of the book, Trauma and the Body, The Sensory Motor Approach to Psychotherapy. Her second book, Sensory Motor Psychotherapy, Interventions for Trauma and Attachment, is a practical guide to integrate sensory motor psychotherapy into the treatment of trauma and attachment issues. Dr. Ogden is currently developing sensory motor psychotherapy for children, adolescents, and families with colleagues. And you've got another book.
That's right. Coming out this year.
Okay. Do you have a title you can share with us?
Well, it's called A Pocket Guide to Sensory Motor Psychotherapy. It was Norton's title. But the exciting part of that book for me is that we're really examining sociocultural considerations for sensory motor psychotherapy. So that's something that's just been a long time coming, and I've been working with for people of color who've been consulting with me, and we've worked a lot with composite cases, one of which I'm going to present today.
So socio-cultural components, perfect timing as we're recording this in the midst of COVID and all these riots.
Right.
So that's due out later this year, you said?
Later this year. I'm not exactly sure when, but hopefully it'll be this year.
Okay. Well, we're going to look forward to certainly that coming out. So I wanted to bring you back to invite you to discuss in more detail certain cases, how sensory motor psychotherapy is applied, what it looks like. I think a lot of people have an idea of what it is. I'm sure a lot of people don't, but I there's something about getting into the details of hearing you, and I say that because I know having gone through level one and level two of sensory motor psychotherapy, I've been able to watch those videos of you work, and they're just so inspiring. Are those still part of the curriculum?
Yes, the videos are still part of the curriculum where students can watch videos of consultation sessions that I've done.
And watch the magic happen. it's amazing to watch. I mean, because it's just watching yourself. I mean, it's just so seasoned. But anyway, all right, so let's get into it. You said you had a case you wanted to talk about. Give us some context here. What are we going to listen to?
Do you want me to talk a little bit about sensory motor psychotherapy?
That would be great. Yeah, sure.
Because what I want to say is that what we look at with sensory motor psychotherapy, we really look at how the body participates in the client's presenting problems. So we're looking at posture and movement and gesture, because everything is experienced through the body. So the body becomes a viable avenue for exploration and change. And, you know, the body really reflects what Alan Shore calls the implicit self, or that which is unconscious. So it can provide a really critical access route into what's underlying the client's complaints. Yeah. So I start with the body from the get-go. So the client I wanted to talk about, I'll call her Jamie. She's an African-American woman, about 35 years old. She grew up in an area that was disproportionately affected by crime. She suffered a lot of racial trauma, from microaggressions like being asked to sweep the floor at a place where she worked, to a white girl not sitting next to her in grade school, to being held at knife point by an older boy, a white boy. She was also raped by her mother's boyfriend, also white. So she had a lot of racialized trauma. And at the very beginning, we really talked about that. And we talked about the difference, since I'm a white woman and she's a black woman, and the privilege oppression dynamics that are just inherent in any kind of relationship like that. So we brought that to the forefront at the beginning. She'd had so much trauma. So when people experience trauma like that, they often have parts of themselves that are rooted in defensive responses, like, you know, instinctive defenses of fight, flight, cry for help, freeze, and feign death. And some of her problems was related to that. She just reported that she struggled with addictions, and she struggled with getting just frozen and immobile, feeling like she couldn't move. She would have panic attacks, especially she reported when her boyfriend was upset with her. So there were many different parts related to the trauma that kind of lived in her body. So we started out the therapy by talking about that, because she didn't really understand that a lot of her dysregulation was due to past trauma. That's what trauma does. It dysregulates the nervous system, and people are often left with these traumatized internal parts that have behaviors that are often described as liabilities by clients. So maybe I could talk about how we map the parts, first of all.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. You said initially you talked about, you know, you're being white and she being African-American. Was that something that you brought up the first session? I mean, how did that come up? That seems like
Right. Well, it came up as she talked about her history in the first session and the topic of racialized trauma. And, you know, I named that she'd had a lot of racialized trauma that was perpetrated by white people. And then, you know, just acknowledge that, I'm white. And what's that like for you? And, you know, we talked a little bit about privilege oppression and how that is going to show up in any relationship, including ours. Mm-hmm. Those dynamics, like there might be times where those dynamics are just coming forward, which they will. And I'll talk about that in a bit, how they came forward.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. So when we map the parts, I like to use just a very simple, almost stick figure drawing on a paper and talk about what happens in her body, for example, when she feels the panic, when her boyfriend's upset with her. And she talked about her chest, that she just felt this fluttering in her chest and like this feeling where everything was going upward. And if we think of instinctive defenses, that was really related to a cry for help part of her that went into a panic at the potential separation with her main attachment person. Yeah. So identifying that, we identified that her addictions, particularly to alcohol, related to a part of her that wanted to get away, a fight part. And as we talked about that, she said she could actually feel a jittery feeling in her legs. So we mark that on the paper. Okay, flight part here, cry for help part in the chest. She had tension in her jaws and arms, which she said related to anger, which we correlated with a fight defense. And she talked about that there would be times when she would just get numb and collapse. Her posture was kind of collapsed anyway. Mm-hmm. And that the shame she felt with that part of herself, we correlated with a shutdown state or a feigned death part. So it was good to map these at the beginning because it kind of gave us a framework to work with. Well, then we could track her body together and notice when these parts would emerge. And with trauma, this is such an important factor because if a client can identify different parts that are emerging, instead of just acting them out, just becoming mm-hmm. that part, they're a step ahead in their healing, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I just want to kind of put a magnifying glass around that. So in a sense, my guess is that this is probably new to the client, this idea of parts. It's, I mean, it's new to a lot of clients that there are different parts that are, you're tracking these different parts and they're expressing different sensations in a sense in her body. And you're as you're doing this, your goal is to do what?
Well, several things really. First is to normalize her experience. Because traumatized clients come in thinking they're just crazy. You know, I can't get out of bed. You know, I have this panic. I have nightmares. I'm just going nuts. And then when you do a little psychoeducation about how trauma stimulates these instinctive defenses, it starts to make sense. Mm-hmm. So it kind of normalizes it and gives hope. Like, we can work with this. These are just instinctive defenses that haven't really gotten integrated. You know, and quieted down from the trauma that you've had. And then second is, because trauma first and foremost affects the body, we want to work with the body, what we call bottom-up processing, to heal the effects of trauma, because it really lives in the body in a dysregulated nervous system and these actions that are related to instinctive defenses.
So. Oftentimes, there's a sense of, oh, okay, that makes sense when exactly. you start doing this.
Yeah.
What was her response when you were mapping this and she was able to see, oh, that part, yes, that's why that does that or that?
Well, I think she started to feel like she wasn't going crazy. Like, right. This is to be expected when you've had that degree of trauma. And it also kind of gave us a language to work with that we could share, a shared language, and helped her just have that little bit of distance, you know, so that she could actually observe these things, that these parts of herself or these different impulses in her body.
Now, up to this point, Pat, had she talked about her traumas in a sense? Had she named them? Where did that come in, the verbalization?
No, she had talked about her trauma, you know, in the initial intake. We talked about her history. We talked about what she wanted to work with, the things she wanted to change. I always like to ask clients what they hope to have different from our work together. That gives me a direction, and I can use their goals to, like, for example, one of the things that she said was that she just felt like I showed her that window of tolerance, you know. And we talked about arousal, and she said she just felt like she was out of that window all the time, and she didn't like that feeling. So I said, well, let's start with something that will kind of resource you, which is standard phase-oriented treatment that was pioneered by Pierre Janet in the late 1800s, that first goal would be stabilization of arousal. So early in our session, I asked her if she could remember something positive, because if she could remember something positive, it would affect her body in a certain way. Like if any of us think of something really good that's happened, we start to, our breath expands, you know, we start to, maybe our spine lengthens. That's what happened to Jamie. She thought about taking cookies to work, and her boss praised her cookies. It was at a party, a office party. And so if she just stayed with that feeling of his praise, her body, her spine started to lengthen, yeah? And her breath started to expand. Now, what was interesting with that was that she felt better with this more upright, expansive posture, but she also felt exposed. Now, see, those are like two different parts. Like one of her parts felt, one of her, part of her felt good, but another part felt like exposed. And she said something like, all my life I've tried to be invisible, and that was her collapsed pulling in posture. Because she said, I don't want anybody to see me because they just hurt me. So what do we do with that, right? Maintain that aligned posture. Well, she felt the exposed feeling in her belly, and she felt anxious in her belly. So she found another resource of self-touch, where she brought her hands to her belly. So those two combine, her hands to her belly, where she's communicating to that feeling, that part of her that was exposed, that communicating some safety, and then she, the aligned posture. So that was really her first resource that we worked with.
All right, guys, just quickly, I want to thank Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute for being a sponsor on this podcast. Do you struggle to help numb disconnected clients who can't feel emotion or explore inner experience? Learn a comprehensive approach to conceptualize your client's concerns. You know, as someone who's gone through the level one and level two trainings of sensory motor psychotherapy training, I can really speak to the power of this training. For me, it was a game changer and is so inspiring. Sensory motor psychotherapy uniquely includes the body and therapy as both a source of information and a target for intervention, because words are not enough. Go beyond theories and gain practical ways to open a new dimension for effective therapy. Visit Sensory Motor Psychotherapy Institute online today at sensorymotor.org. That's sensorymotor.org.
In sensory motor psychotherapy, we always want to work with homework. So she went home and she practiced that. She practiced aligning her posture and keeping her hands or her arms, you know, over the part of her in her belly where she felt the anxiety.
Was that scary for her?
To align her posture?
Well, just to be exposed, or to, you know, to feel that lengthening and so forth.
It was both. It felt good. And she felt like, what were her words? I think she just said, feels good, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're in a collapsed, tight posture, if your spine is slumped, it interferes with so many things. You know, your confidence, your ability to breathe deeply doesn't give much room for your heart and your organs. So both on a physical level and an emotional level, it felt good to lengthen her spine. But it was scary for that other part of her who felt exposed. And for her, if she's exposed, she could get hurt. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was important that she also tend to that, the part that felt exposed, with a gesture of protection.
Yeah. I want to jump in here for a second. One of the things that really struck me when I was watching those videos of you talking to clients and working with clients was that not only were you just so at ease, but there was a kind of an implicit, there was a confidence about you. There was a, you kind of exuded hope. Like, we're going to get through this. And I don't have a question there, but just respond to that.
Well, this work in sensory motor psychotherapy is based on foundational principles that I really believe in. One is organicity, a term borrowed from Gregory Bateson, that has to do with that each living system has its own intelligence and its own path to evolution, and that it's always there. And so as a therapist, you want to create the context where that intelligence can emerge. I mean, if you have faith in that the client is moving towards healing and health anyway, they are, given the right conditions. All you have to do is create the conditions. You know, so I do have confidence and I do have hope. There's that concept, it's a Taoist concept, I believe. It's called Wu Wei, I think. I think that's the right way to pronounce it. And it's about non-doing, because if you're going in the direction that the system is already moving in, you're just kind of nurturing it along. You don't have to do a lot. So every client has, you can capitalize on that own organicity. They're already moving. There's already the impulse to heal, the impulse to wellness. And all the therapist has to do is follow that impulse. Yeah. Makes it a lot easier. You don't have to push. You know?
So she's moving along here. She's feeling resourced in a sense to a certain degree. How do things unfold with her?
Well, there were different elements. I remember one kind of important memory for her was coming home from school, and she asked her mom for a hug. And she had a really bad day. And her mom said, you're too big for hugs. And she felt so rejected. And she felt so alone. So, and there were a couple elements of that, you know. I mean, this was one way that racial history came into the therapy room, was that we wanted to contextualize that, because Black girls are often socialized to exude this veneer of strength and toughness and self-sufficiency, because they have to deal with so much strife. Like Jamie did in the world. So Black children are often encouraged to be tough. And we talked about that. There's many authors and research that have written about this. And we talked about that not to take away her pain in any way, but to contextualize what had happened to her. And then from there, we could more easily work with that internalized message that was emotionally painful for her, because the message was, I don't deserve support. I'm just on my own. I don't deserve support. Yeah. So when she then, after we kind of contextualized it, this is kind of how it works in therapy. We sort of go back and forth between working purely bottom up with trauma, and then working with emotions, the body, and beliefs when we're dealing with attachment-related wounds. So this was a wound, I don't deserve to support, that she learned in relationship with her mother. And when we went into that wound, her body started to collapse again. And that really represented this child part of her that was so hurt. And in so much pain about feeling so alone and undeserving. So at this point, we were able to kind of stay with that collapse. She went into the feeling, she cried, and, you know, from, it's almost like when a person can express that pain of the younger part in the presence of an empathic therapist, which she didn't have as a child, she didn't have that empathy, then something opens up, right? And things can start to shift. So after the tears, we were able to work with shifting that belief. I remember I said to her, I wanted to say something to that child part to find out what happened to that child that she was so in touch with. And the words I said was, you do deserve support. And after the tears, she could take that in. Mm-hmm. And it felt true to her. Yeah. And what was really nice was that she could also communicate that to the child part, herself, her adult 35-year-old self. So together we were recognizing, you know, that concept of recognition that the psychoanalysts talk about, that the recognition of another person gives meaning to your feelings and your actions and to who you are. So in a way, both of us were able to recognize that child part and all her pain and all her need. And then that child part could feel the nurturance and the acceptance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we worked with the posture again. Can I just say this one more thing?
Yeah, of course.
Because the child part was a part of her that kept small, and the adult part, you know, could find that alignment. So this time we worked with her body differently, where she went in to the body of the child, which was more collapsed, and then she went up into a more aligned posture, but which kind of left that hurt little girl behind. So we experimented together with going into the collapse and then finding that degree of upright posture that included that child rather than excluded that child. Wow. And it was palpable. She could really feel it, you know? It wasn't a big all-the-way alignment. It was kind of halfway. And then she could very tenderly still be with that child part. That was really cool element.
Wow. Yeah. You talked about attachment trauma and the way you work with attachment trauma. You said that you kind of go back and forth between working with the body and working with emotions. Oh, why is that?
Well, and that was illustrated in that last little segment that, you know, through our attachment relationships, we're making meaning and we're formulating beliefs that really live in the body as well. But there are strong emotions related to, as John Bowlby would say, the formation, the disruption, and the maintenance of attachment relationships. Like Jamie had such strong emotion around that memory with the mother when she felt so rejected by her mother. Oh, she was just sobbing, you know. So to resolve those attachment-related wounds, we want to be able to work with that strong emotion. We want to be able to work with the belief. Like for Jamie, it was, I don't deserve any support. And we want to work with how that lives in the body. You know? See, with trauma, and I had to learn this in my early years as a therapist, trauma is really better resolved bottom up. Like the rage and the terror that go with trauma are what Pierre Janet would call vehement emotions. And they're really designed to fuel like a fight or flight, you know, a defensive response. And Janae talked about, if you try to process those, it's just circular. You know, it doesn't go anywhere. So we really want to integrate trauma bottom up through the body. Whereas with relational wounds, we work with beliefs, with cognition, emotion, and the body, kind of all three. Yeah.
So hence the back and forth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Every client that I've ever seen, I think, has both. So yeah, we weave back and forth. Yeah. After that, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and in terms of sensory motor psychotherapy, for those people who are listening, what would you say that the tools that it gives therapists to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, basically, sensory motor psychotherapy will give. It's a whole system that's meant to be adjunctive. You know, like all our the people we trained are licensed therapists, but it gives you the tools you need to work with the body as a healing force in your therapy. Like, for example, if I can say a little bit more about Jamie,
of course.
And working with the traumatic memory, like finally, she really wanted to work with that memory of when the boy had held her at knife point. It was a sexual abuse situation, and he had called her a racial slur. And that the sound of his voice was so vivid for her, right? So we call that a sliver. We could take that little sliver of memory where she just heard the sound of his voice and noticed what happened in her body. Because you see, we want to stimulate the active defenses that she was not able to execute during the time of that actual traumatic event. So she, of course, had to just become immobile and just submit to his abuse because, I mean, that's an instinct. She didn't consciously decide to do that, but instinctively, that was the best decision. He had a knife. He was older. He was bigger. She couldn't get away. She couldn't fight him back. That doesn't mean that the impulses to get away and fight back don't still reside in the body. So when she, in therapy, heard the sound of his voice, her fingers lifted just slightly off her lap. In ethology, they call that a preparatory movement, a preparation for another action. So I hope the listeners can get the sense of how the memory itself, because we're working bottom up with the body, the memory itself stimulates actions in the body that need to be executed. So she felt that little lifting of her fingers, the content of the memory had done the work. Her body wanted to push away, like violently. That impulse came from her body, not from her mind. And this is bottom-up work. It came from the body, and so I held a pillow, and she pushed really hard against the pillow, and it felt so empowering for her. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, the memory was irrelevant. We weren't even... I think I said, oh, just feel your body now. Don't even think about the memory. Mm-hmm. Because the point is to reestablish that ability to push away in her body on a bodily level.
I can feel it. I love it.
Yeah, that was a real... Janae would call that an act of triumph. Mm. He said people affected by traumatic memory have not been able to execute the acts of triumph. And it's an act of triumph in the body, right?
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So that felt really good to her.
Wow, wow, wow. Well, Pat, awesome. It you know, again, listening to you talk about these things, it can sound easy, but it's not. I mean, just hearing you talk about those, her fingers coming off her lap, you had to notice that, right?
Right. That's right. That's
I mean,
right.
You had to have the experience to be there and to notice that and to know what to do with that. But that's just true. To hear you talk about that is just—it's exciting to me to hear you talk about that and to learn what happened, how things unfolded for her, and how mm-hmm. she was able to manifest that in her body. Mm-hmm. Wow! All right. So, as we close up here. Your new book is coming, going to be coming in several months. We'll obviously keep up to date on that. And you folks, have a webcast. I'm going to talk about that after in a little bit, but,
okay.
it's a pleasure having you on here. It's more than a pleasure. It's an honor having you on here and pinning you down to have you talk about these details like this. It's exciting. And I know my listeners are like, yes, guy, you got it.
And, well, it's great to share this with you. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
All right, Pat. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Thank you so much for checking out the podcast. I really appreciate it. And if you're a new trauma therapist, if you're a student, if you're passionate about learning about trauma, if you're just starting out on your trauma-informed journey, I want to invite you to check out my membership community, Trauma Therapist 2.0. It's specifically dedicated to therapists of all kinds who are just starting out, who want to be around other people who are doing this work, who are passionate about learning and learning from seasoned professionals. Check out Trauma Therapist 2.0. That's Trauma Therapist 2.0. The number 2.com. Traumatherapist, the number 2.com. All right. Have a great day.